Good morning. I'm going to talk today about Worldforge, a project I've been doing for a very, very long time now. My name is Alistair Riddock. I'm the lead server programmer. And the very, very handsome gentleman in the back in blue is Eric, our lead client programmer, who you'll be hearing from later. I was going to call my talk today The Dynamic Data-Driven Worlds of Worldforge, but I could equally easily have called it Data-Driven and Component-Based Game Entities in Worldforge. It's supposed to be dark.
It's supposed to be unreadable.
Can you read it?
No.
I can read it.
I guess not.
But for reasons that will become obvious, I had to pick a colour that worked on lots of backgrounds.
Well, it's not the best contrast.
There's something.
That is supposed to be dark. Basically, I'm going to start by wildly agreeing with everything the previous guy said. We've been down exactly the same road, having started with a system based on nasty hard-coded class hierarchies in Python, and we ended up with a system that I'll talk about in a bit that's based much more on entities and components. But I'm going to start off with talking about where we began. You can read that? No?
No. Yeah, I can. It's challenging.
The contrast is really clear from the different angle on my screen.
Yeah.
Shall I read it out to you then?
Yes,
I can read
please.
It out to you. Actually, it doesn't really matter. I'm just going to talk, and you can ignore what it says up there. Worldforge is a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, whereas MMO is the kind of common abbreviation. And MMOs and free and open source software have a very, very common history in a sense. When in, I think it was 1977, the version 6 Unix source code was released, which is one of the sort of very, very pivotal moments in the history of open source that led to a lot of the other things that will become what we now know as. It was just a few months before Roy Trubshaw started work on the first ever MUD at Essex University. And 20 years later, when in 1998, I think it was, the Open Source Initiative was founded, which is one of the key moments in open source becoming much more mainstream. I'm not saying Open Source Initiative caused it to become mainstream, but it was one of those things that happened during the same period. It was just a few months away from the launch of Ultima Online, which was the first really, really successful big commercial game of the MUD genre, which then became known as the Massively Multiplayer Online Role-Playing Game, or MMO genre later. So it should be no surprise whatsoever that only a few months after that, Slashdot announced the formation of the Altima project, which was a bunch of people who wanted to get together and build something out of free software to do something similar to Altima Online, but be more free. But unfortunately, none of them could really agree what free meant. So this is a picture of the installation CDs for World of Warcraft. There's 5 CDs there. In addition to these 5 CDs, if you play World of Warcraft, you have to deal with downloading massive patches, and you have to buy upgrades, or expansions as they call them, which are also lots of CDs each. Lots and lots of data. A year after World Form as Altima, there was another announcement on Slashdot, which changed its name to Worldforge. And the core reason behind that was a trademark issue. Altima is the name of a car in the United States, and it was also very, very similar to Ultima, a little bit too similar for comfort. But actually, a lot of things about the project had changed as well. One of the first things that had been unclear about the project was what freely really meant. Ultima Online wasn't just non-free in that the code wasn't available. It was also non-free, as in you had to pay a lot to buy the box that it came in. And also, on top of that, you had to pay quite a lot of money for a monthly subscription for the right to continue playing the game. So there were all sorts of people for whom free meant freedom from various different kinds of constraints that game had. And there were also wildly different opinions amongst the huge number of people that had come together to make the project about what they really wanted to build. There were the sort of role-playing... I was going to use a different word, but the role-playing authoritarians who wanted to run a strict rule that everybody in the world had to role-play, and anybody who made any kind of out-of-character reference would be banned. There were the people who wanted to build 3D games. There were the people who wanted to build 2D isometric games, and nobody could create anything. So with the change to WorldForge, okay, came a completely different approach, and we started thinking not just in terms of building a single game, because nobody could agree what that game was, and instead we started working on a sort of core set of technologies so that we could all build the game that we wanted, theoretically. This is a device, really, right? I think many of us knew, I wasn't even in the project at the time, but people knew that we couldn't really build all the games we wanted to build, but we had to come up with some kind of common reference so that we could actually just get on with some writing some code. Because if we just argued about what we're going to build, we'd never write anything. This is a picture of an area of Ultima Online's wilderness. You can tell it's wilderness because there's houses everywhere. Ultima Online allowed player housing, and very, very shortly after launch, every single area of the world that was possible to build housing on was full of housing. So I showed you a picture earlier of the enormous number of CDs you need to download, to install World of Warcraft. And that is a big problem, because we're still talking about the late 90s when we launched WorldForge, and we knew that having these great big worlds, big enough so that you wouldn't immediately get full of player housing if you allowed player housing, was going to mean we're going to have to ship lots and lots of data. And at this point in history, most people were still on dial-up, and it was possible to play World of Warcraft Online on dial-up. On dial-up, but it was impossible to download all the data that you needed to play it, and we didn't have access to the enormous amounts of resources that you need to get a decent number of people able to download that content, and the players didn't have the possibility to do it themselves. So we had to create techniques and tools and everything to make it possible for us to build the kind of scale of worlds that we wanted without those enormous downloads, especially as all the different members of the projects had different ideas of the game they wanted to build. So we weren't just talking about one enormous set of data to download, we were talking about an enormous set of data to download for every single one. So, quite early on, in the early 2000s, well, after we'd sort of settled down and decided what we were actually going to do, we started working fairly hard on completely different ways of expressing our game data, expressing it much more concisely, and only having the players download the data they really need. And one of the solutions we arrived at quite early on was something that eventually evolved into something very, very like the entity component-based system that the previous speaker talked about. So I won't bother to explain what entity component-based system is because the guy has just spent the last 3/4 hours doing that for me. But our system is... our entities still inherit from other entities, so as he talked about in the later slides there, they have components which are possible to add to any different entity to make it gain different kind of properties. You can embed entities hierarchically inside each other as makes sense, and then when a client connects to the world and wants to get a view of what bit of the world it's looking at, you can just make a sensible decision based on what the character who that client is playing can see, send them those entities, and it uses that entity data to build up an image of the world. And in addition to the way that we do that, we also make these entities that describe the world describe it in an abstract sense. This means we don't go into a lot of detail about the exact polygon data or fine geometry of what's going on, because the server doesn't need that. It can express it to the client, and the client can basically use data files that it has on the local disk to build up and render it. And it works. It works pretty well. This is a screenshot from the motion picture Star Trek II, and this is a view of a fictional sort of simulated planet in a sort of movie that's played within the movie. And the planet is created by a thing called the Genesis device. The Genesis device is a thing that basically makes enormous dynamic worlds using technology, just like WorldForge. So terrain data is really, really, really huge. It's one of the most things that's the biggest problem with any MMO is the massive amount of data you need to define the terrain. It's absolutely staggering that previous screenshot was made in 1982 when the biggest computers that were available to like normal people had nowhere near enough data to even get close to rendering the amount of terrain we saw there. So the way we chose to deal with this was to use a procedural system to describe our terrain. As I understand it, the system used to generate the terrain data we saw in that previous shot is referred to as quasi-random midpoint displacement, where you basically take a small set of corner points which define the edge of your terrain, you jump to the point in the middle of them, you add a random offset, which is proportional to the difference between the two heights of the corner points. You perturb it, and then you keep doing that iteratively until you fill it the whole thing with data points defining your terrain height. And you end up with some quite nice looking, fairly natural looking terrain, like the terrain in the background. You can see that picture. I can see it quite clearly from here, right? Nod if you can see the picture. People sort of shake their head slightly. And then we came up with algorithms we can use to make smart decisions about how to texture that terrain based on how steep it is, how high it is. You can't see much here, but if you look sort of here, there's a bit of bare rock exposed there. There's an algorithm for defining when terrain has grass on it. There's one based on elevation to describe where it has snow on it. And all the parameters for the algorithms that define that are all data-driven, and they're all basically in the components. So in order for an object to have some terrain in it, it just has a terrain component attached to that object, that entity, and that terrain component has sub-properties which define the parameters for the algorithms that should be used to shade the terrain. So this is a screenshot from Star Wars Galaxies. It uses a somewhat different system based on Perlin noise to generate its terrain, but it's all similarly driven, data-driven and procedural. The unfortunate thing about this screenshot is that there's really not a lot going on in it. There's like some nice rolling hills, a few little plants and a lake, but not a lot else. And this is because procedural content is pretty dull. It doesn't really matter how clever you make your algorithms or resources. People who are playing the game will eventually see through the fact that you just generated it all using an algorithm. So you need, with any procedural system, a way to enhance the procedural output to make it more interesting, make it add basically content to that, and content that's produced by real people. So we did that by firstly allowing modifications to be specified. This means that you can have an object which has another component attached to it, and the component says that when you place this entity in another entity which has some terrain on it, it modifies that terrain. You can make a hole, you can make a hill, you can make an area flat where there's lumpy, so you can put a house on it. And as soon as we'd done this, it became obvious that we didn't need to just limit the ability to make these to world designers and game designers. You could actually make it so that you could create these entities that have these components describing terrain modifications as part of the gameplay. Your character can pick up a shovel, and it can use the shovel on the ground, and that creates a terrain mod component on an entity, and then as you're using the shovel on that, it changes. And we were able to build gameplay mechanisms that allowed you to build earth-based fortifications with ditches and dikes and mounds and stuff that you can build a castle on, which is really, really awesome. We've also done a bunch of work, which is far from finished. I think Eric has done most of this, on procedurally putting vegetation on the terrain. You actually see some of it here. There's some plants in the foreground. Maybe I should ask Eric to talk about this, but I won't. The algorithm allows you to specify that you want certain types of vegetation on low ground near water, certain different kinds of vegetation elsewhere. And I've done some work on procedurally generated forests, where you just create an entity and then add a property to it saying that it's got a distribution of different entities within it that are again defined by parameters of that component, which just, you know, alter the probability of various different tree species that the objects represent. I should get around to get that into the game because it's awesome tech and we haven't actually got it in there yet. And this is a picture of a house in World of Warcraft that is on fire. I haven't actually been to this part of World of Warcraft, but based on what I know about World of Warcraft, I'm pretty sure this house is always on fire and it never burns down. And the thing about the world the way we do it with entities and components is that everything is mutable. When you make a house on fire in World Forge, you add a component to say this is on fire. Eric's beautiful rendering code makes it a particle system, and then the component can over time affect other properties like how damaged the building is, and eventually the building can get destroyed and deleted. Once we've got this sort of being able to build fortifications and castles and that kind of stuff, oh yeah, we can build cities. And we're building a world gradually that not just world designers and game designers can have an impact on, but the players who play the games can actually have an impact on. They can change the world, because absolutely everything is defined, rather than by this massive great big chunk of data on CDs, it's defined by these entities and these components, all of which downloaded on the fly. And players of commercial world are always going on about how much they want to be able to change the world. Designers argue a lot about how actually they don't really want to, but I'm sure there are some players out there who really do want to, and we're hoping to make a game that will be really, really awesome for them. So what else are we going to do? One of the things that we're not that great at the moment is mapping the abstract data which the server sends out in the form of these entities and components onto arbitrary renderable content on some server in the web, and having the client download and render it. This is something we really need to work quite hard on if we're going to make it possible for people to build their own games, because the only way people get to build their own games at the moment is to create a great big bundle of renderable media and ship it with the client. We have sort of an update process for that, but much more dynamic game content driven play system is probably going to be a lot better. And the really, really big project that I've been on it myself to fix, and everybody else has wanted me to, is getting really good physics engine into the server so that we can actually model things a lot better and have some more interesting things. But the entity-based, component-based system makes it really, really easy to do that from the architecture point of view, just a question of getting the physics built in. So, any questions about that? Yeah?
How do you distribute terrain changes?
To the terrain modifications?
Yeah, how do you distribute it to the other players in the area?
So the other players in the area will be able to see the entities which have the components attached to them which cause the modifications to be made to the terrain. So one of the ways we've done this is if you want to have a house on a particular terrain, you attach a component to that house which says that around this house there's an area of flat terrain so we can build a house on it. That house entity is stored on the server in abstract form. It's much like the YAML sort of data structure that we saw earlier.
So free modelling is not really possible, right?
Free bat-map modelling of the terrain is not something we support yet. Okay. We have various different kinds of terrain mods. Mostly we can vary the sort of shape of them. We can vary whether they raise or lower the terrain. We plan to make that a lot richer, but just making the terrain flat in various areas and just being able to raise or lower it is a lot of what we want to be able to do. It powers a lot of things. Any more questions?
After the world is created, I mean, first the server sends the data, and from that the client creates the procedural world. The modification on this generated world, is this done before or after the actual polygons are created? Because I was thinking, if there's a huge plane, there would be probably not many polygons to be involved in it. So I wonder if you want to make very fine-grained changes, for example, very small holes, then you would need to delete the polygons again and replace them somehow, put them around the hole.
So on the server side, I don't worry too much about that, because I don't have to. The guy who worries about that is sitting too deep to the left, and you ask him.
Yeah, well, basically, when the frame changes, we have to regenerate the mesh that defines the... and that's not something I just have to the... the technique we're using for the terrain engine. So I mean, if you have a large net terrain, you could probably optimize it by having a lesser number of polygons together to be kept anyway. But that's purely something for the client. I mean, it depends on the average you're using for generating the terrain. But basically, so what this means is that you can have multiple people online in the same world, and and altering the terrain in real time, and it's being displayed to everyone. So if someone is digging a hole somewhere and you're standing next to the character, you will see the hole being dug.
And if you want to,
what I mean, that's being worked on, it's just some algorithm. And after the algorithm is finished, you have probably a polygon mesh.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, we generate the mesh.
You have to work on that.
Yeah. So you generate the height map, and then you apply the modifications, and then from that, you generate the polygon mesh.
The algorithm for generating the height map from the defining points, which are in the component data, runs in a few milliseconds. So you can regenerate and apply modification to it in pretty much real time. I think you do it in another thread, right?
Yeah.
But you can't do it between frames, but you can do it so quickly that it regenerates invisible.
Yeah.
Away. Any more?
How do you deal with roads? How do you plan to deal with roads?
So a road is going to be, I think, a terrain mod which is defined by the linear path that it is. It's got a width, and the algorithm we then apply within that is a smoothing thing. And then another part to it is another modification which says that part should be textured differently. And we can transmit that from server to client pretty minimally as just an object, a component that defines a line, and then other components that say it's got a width, so make it wider, apply it in that way.
And so you have a way to do texture splatting or something to paint the road?
Yes, we do, yeah. I didn't talk about that, but yeah. So another way in which we use that, you can't see it on here, is, for example, if you place a tree in the world, that has a component on it which says the circular terrain around the tree shouldn't be grass, it should be a leaf pattern, so that the tree has dropped leaves, they stayed on the ground. And that works pretty well as well.
Do you have cities, and are they procedurally generated as well?
We don't have cities because we have gone for a kind of game design for our core game, that's the one that Eric and I are working on as core developers, where the players will build the cities themselves. I do every now and again read articles on procedural cities, and they look pretty interesting. But this does go back to my comment about procedural content being dull. You can create a procedural city, but when you walk around it, it starts to become pretty obvious to me that this is procedural.
That was what I was asking, because one thing, it is one thing to build a procedural forest.
Yeah.
It's another thing to build a procedural urban area. Because you can very easily, especially if you're working with tile sets or anything, you can very easily see the repetition in the building types and everything.
Yeah.
So that was the point of the question.
It will be interesting to do it. I think actually more likely what will happen is that there will be AI entities running around the world who are trying to build cities themselves. And they will obviously have some sort of procedural stuff in their AI to make it look decent. But it will just be for colour rather than being the actual cities that people use. Any more?
So the texturing, you say you have algorithms for snow.
Yeah.
Are they run on the server or on the client side?
Both. Separately. So the data that we transmit between server and client is very abstract and very minimal, and then we only.
I was thinking how does it work out if you have a desert area and a grass area somewhere else?
Yeah.
So are both algorithms for the textures of the sand and the grass, is it defined on the client if it should be either one of those?
So the server will send very concise data saying what the parameters of the code. We have a library that basically has all this terrain code in it. So the server says, create a shader, we would call it. It's not a shader in the graphic sense of it, but it's referred to as a terrain shader. Create a shader and pass in these name parameters, and one of them will be like thresholds. For example, the snow has a threshold, a low threshold, above which it's snow. So we say pass that in to the terrain system, and then when the terrain system runs and builds the texture passes. It just builds that texture pass in at that right, that correct threshold. And we actually do run those shading stages on both the server and the client, but the server is not interested in having enough data to render it. The server just wants to have enough data so that when somebody does something to a particular point in the ground, the server knows what the material on the ground is. So for example, I wrote a script a while back where some character would use a pickaxe to quarry stone so that you could acquire stone as a building material. That script checks the point on the train where you clicked and checks what the surface of the train is there. And if it's rock, it works. If it's not rock, it doesn't. The client needs much, much more data. It needs to generate alpha textures to use to do the texture blending and stuff like that. So it's a much more expensive step there. But the code is all configurable so that you can do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Also for season changes, I thought...
We haven't dealt with that yet. I'm sorry, you.
How big is the procedural, the generated procedural content you have in the game compared to the actual data that it needs to be downloaded? Because to me it seems, I look at the picture, there are some very fine textures and so on. And today I think the world would be pretty smallish, all the data that is currently generated procedurally, compared to the textures and all the other stuff that has to be downloaded by the client.
So the way we do terrain is that there is a grid of control points which are on a regular square grid, and the points on them are 64 meters apart. Mm. It's a power of two for a good reason. And each of those control points is just, at its minimum, it's just a single floating point value saying, at this particular point on the 64 meter grid, the height of the train is this value. And given four of those control points, the quasi-random midpoint displacement algorithm is trivially able to generate a 64 by 65 array of height points to control that. So you go from four values to 64 by 65 values, which is obviously way more. That's a really good compression ratio.
But I just wondered how it compares to the size of data you need for playing the game. If you generate all these, if it's worthwhile compression, if you compare it to the all the pix maps you have and all the models you have in the game.
The texture images don't have to be transferred from the client to the server at all. They're in the package of media which it gets from elsewhere. Yeah. And once it has a grass texture, it has that grass texture forever. So it doesn't need to update it unless we decide that we want to upload a pretty one.
If the information of the world is maintained in an abstract fashion on the server side, does that mean that different clients can see the world in very different ways because of the representation of simple concepts as grass or vegetation?
They can and sometimes do render it somewhat differently, but the important properties of the world should be the same, no matter how it's rendered. So the grass should be grass in the same place.
Yeah, but I can choose to change the actual entity that is drawn on screen. Basically, alter my local files in a way that it doesn't break the game, but it just shows the world differently. I can do that.
Yeah, you can make a nicer grass texture and the one that just you have, and make it look pretty. Yeah.
Or make an AI that it just uses the abstract representation and runs around.
So part of the reason for having that abstract representation in the fairly rich hierarchy way is that it is quite easy for AIs to navigate that and do something sensible. And we have a bunch of Python and AI code, which does pretty cool stuff. Mm-hmm. All of which was written before I started, so I don't know much about it, but I've played with it. Did I actually answer your previous question? I started answering another one.
Yeah.
And you had a question, right?
Do you have any fluids in the game for like rivers and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm. Do I have any? Sorry.
Fluids, like fluid mechanics or anything.
We thought about it, but we haven't got there yet.
Yeah.
I've seen references to Bullet having some fluid stuff, but I haven't dug into it very much. Okay. Bullet is the system I'm planning to use for physics, so if we can get some fluids in there with that, that would be awesome. Yeah.
So, how many contributors do you have? How is your development speed?
Way, way less than we had at the beginning. When we started, we were like 60, 70, 80 people. The honest truth is that right now, the only really two full-time people we have are me and Eric. We have a bunch of Summer of Code students, which are very cyclic. They come in for Summer of Code and then they go off and do their studies for a bit.
Who pays you? How do you get paid?
Full-time
guys?
I do something else for a living.
Oh, but you're still full-time on the game?
No, I mean, like, I'm full-time as a hobby on the game. As in, I don't quit. But no, my day job is working for Google on something completely unrelated to this. So. Yep.
When I have a house that is burning down, so the actual synchronization that when there are two players moving at the house burning, does it happen on server or
All of your target data about the world is always on the server. So the model, the script modeling how the fire burns will always be on the server, and then that will just generate visibility updates, as opposed to say sound updates. Just saying, at this point the simulation run determined the house has got a little bit destroyed, so we send out an update to all the clients that are have characters that can see that particular event, and they all should be able to render a difference in the way the house works. Obviously we can't have, it's very difficult to do a continuously burning down house. You have to do it in sort of simulated steps.
Excuse me?
I have an idea. sure.
The choice of a dynamic data-driven model is a better choice rather than a component-based to handle the continuous flow of modification around the world, or it is just a choice you pick up?
I don't think that's a choice at all. I think component-based, entity-based systems are very data-driven if you do them well. A lot of what the previous guy talked about the way they do stuff, applies exactly to the way we do stuff. So our entities and our components are all extremely data-driven. Is that not your question, or?
So you mean that you can use both the approach in the same time, and or so they can even be the same thing?
Can you just restate what you think the two different approaches are? Because as far as I'm aware, there's only one approach in your question. So.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, they choose to use. The data-driven architecture is a technical needed choose, or is just the option you chose back in time can be there could be a difference. I mean about performance. I mean about
so data-driven solutions are slower in terms of performance, that's certainly true. As the previous speaker spoke about component-based systems being slower, but they are so much more flexible that any mature big project will end up being data-driven. If you read books written by people in the games industry about how they build games, everything is always data-driven. It's the only way you can really build a decent-sized big game.
I think the question was if it's needed from a technical point of view that you use a component-based system, or if that's just like a personal preference on your part that you chose it.
I think we violently agree that it's something that you just have to agree. Is that the case?
Yeah.
I think you end up having to. Because other approaches just break down and fail to work. Beyond a certain point.
Eventually reach a point where it will just fail with other approaches. It's too difficult to keep them working and to create content for them.
Yeah.
You have the content basically as an extra component. It's by far more easy to modify content, create content, and do it together.
I would venture guess that most of them have part of the release that they chose to restrict it.
Possibly. Because after a while, especially with open source and with open games, you don't have a really, you don't have a clear vision, and you don't have someone who's a producer who can decide where you want to go. It's more elastic, and this is more elastic if you have a more rigid architecture. It becomes more and more possible to change stuff later on. And I would say that's probably a good guess why most open source games fail after a while, because it's too expensive for people to change things a bit on an early abandonment.
Especially too difficult for new people to get into the project. Therefore, understand the entirety of the code to kill something.
Yeah.
If you have a bigger game, it's just so much code that it's impossible to understand. So what's the...
It does take a lot of time to switch from the hierarchy based, I suppose, hard coded everything to data driven component stuff. I think it probably was 5 or 6 years of iterative hacking for me. But I never looked read up on component based stuff and went, oh, that's awesome, we should switch to that. I just gradually evolved the design and moved away from hierarchy and towards what I now know are called components, thanks to the talk today. I would call them properties. Any more questions? If you are putting your hand up, wave it harder, I can't see it. Okay, thank you very much indeed. Oh.
It's a question. When the client first connected, it downloaded the chunk of the water that it is interested in.
Yeah.
And then all the other updates, for example, if another player comes in, are incremental updates.
Yeah.
And how do you handle and the period of time between the first download and the updating?
So the first download isn't one great big chunk of data. The client does queries based on things it sees, and as it gets back responses to those queries contain references to other things it can see, and it uses those references to query those other things until it runs out of things that it sees. And then mixed in with that data flow, there will be any incremental updates for things it's already seen during that time. We haven't found that to be overwhelming problem yet. It might become a problem, but we have to work more on in time. Not sure. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.